the need to know. I mentioned that it was also practiced in medieval Europe, where it was called docta ignorantia, or systematic practiced don't know. And I mentioned that it's part of the Zen practice when you're asked, what is the sound of one hand clapping? It's like, what? Don't know. Just hold that. With equanimity. When you listen to a good Vipassana talk, you come away with a sense of clarity and understanding. When you listen to a Zen talk, you're completely confused, but hopefully don't care. That's the difference in the style. I mention this because I'm afraid that a significant proportion of you will have to do the practice of equanimity with don't know, specifically with regards to the approximately 10 to the ninth power questions that you have left for me. That's a billion. Well, okay, that's an exaggeration. It's not a billion, but it sort of seems that many to me. Given the amount of time that I'm going to have to actually answer questions, it's effectively infinite number of questions have been asked of me in the last couple days. Well, do the math. I'm not going to be able to address all of those. So it doesn't mean that I don't care about you and that your question isn't important, but do your best to have equanimity. Rakefet told me a story. You want to tell that story? Yeah, you tell it. It's good.
I
do
it?
Yeah.
It seemed that Shinzen was a bit concerned about not being able to answer all the questions, and we've been getting equally amount of requests for answering questions from Shinzen, equally to the amount of people writing us notes saying, please, enough with the questions in the hall, we want some silence. So Shinzen is trying to balance these two requests. So I told him that many years ago I sat in India a month-long retreat, and at the end of the retreat there was a sharing circle, and what we were asked to answer is something we are grateful about. And it got to my turn. I said, I'm grateful to the teachers. I turned to the teachers and I said, I'm grateful to you for not answering every question I had in this retreat. Because the mind can be a questioning, creating machine. Questions creating machine. And in essence, by not answering my questions in that retreat, they allowed me the experience that Shinzen is telling us about, the experience of resting in not knowing. And that is at least just as valuable experience as getting our questions answered. So it's not may not be a comfortable experience for the mind, but it's a valuable experience. So enjoy.
Or not. Okay, thank you. So we talked about what mindfulness is, and we talked about why practice it. One of the facets of why practice it that I didn't go into detail about is with regards to what might be described as positive behavior change. Sometimes people have the idea that meditation is just about achieving certain experiences that are in our senses. But actually, it's also about our objective behavior in the world. Now, when we started this retreat, I talked about the fivefold sila. So that's one's character or one's behavior within a sort of broad ethical guideline. The idea being that you follow certain ethical guidelines, and that sets the stage for being able to do the practice. The practice then brings about insight and purification. But then one of the places that we apply that insight and purification is once again back in the world of human behavior. So we all have things that we do that we would like to do differently. How does this practice apply to behavior change? Well, the principle is very simple, actually. Objective patterns of behavior, what you eat, what you say, whether you exercise or don't exercise, whether you procrastinate or don't, if you indulge in substances, if you're a compulsive shopper, okay, etc., etc. Objective patterns of behavior are controlled by urges. And urges come up as sensory events. When you have a desire for something, you get perhaps a mental picture.
Urges is caffeine.
Yeah. Urges, desires that control behaviors. You get, could be involved mental picture, could be talk about, oh, I need it, I want it, the image of it, or the image of not having it. And then there's the sensations, the fear flavor of feel associated with not getting, the sad, poor me flavor of feel associated with not getting, and then the smile, joy, interest feel associated with getting the desire. Remember I said I call those the three R's, fear, tear, and cheer, okay? They, in feel space, those are the main drivers that control people's behaviors. Then you can have touch space involved too. If you are attempting to control your eating, well, there's hunger sensations, there's fullness sensations to deal with. If you're trying to stop smoking, then there's the withdrawal sensations in touch space, and then you've got the irritability, impatience, fear, sadness in feel space. So touch, feel, image, talk, these sensory strands that I'm teaching you to separate and love to death. That's equanimity, to love things to death, to affirm them out of existence, although that seems like a contradiction in terms. In any event, the behaviors are controlled by arisings in touch, feel, image, talk, or perhaps just feel, image, talk. So to the extent that you can bring mindfulness to an urge, let's say, for example, the urge to smoke cigarettes. So now I want to smoke. Why do I want to smoke in this moment? I'd like to quit smoking, but I have this strong urge to smoke. Why? How is that coming up in this moment in terms of tangible sensory experience? Well, I've got the yucky sensation that's gonna of withdrawal that's gonna go away if I smoke. Then I've got the fear, tear, cheer, feel flavors. I've got the image of smoking. I get a smile on my face when I get that image. And then I've got the, well, maybe I'll just have one, okay, in talk space, or, you know, well, I can quit any time, so I think I'll do it next week as opposed to this week. Okay, once again, that's talk. So your ability to divide and conquer, to separate that, not suppress it, allow it to be there, with clarity is also your ability not to believe that state, not to buy into it, which means that when you bring mindfulness skills to that urge in that moment, it may be possible to stay with it until it passes, and you don't have to act on it. And then it comes back, of course, and then you have to do it again, and then it comes back, and you have to do it again, over and over and over again. So it's in that way that this practice can be used to change behaviors. I consider it very important that we use this practice to change behaviors, that we not just use this practice to subjectively, in our senses, have certain experiences, etc., etc. So if it seems to you like you're making progress in meditation, but the people around you say you're the same old bastard you used to be, well, that's important feedback, okay? Something's not right here. Some behaviors that need to change are not being addressed, and one has to be willing to take that feedback. And then you can apply the practice to making those behavior changes. So you can attempt to do this, and one of two things will happen. It will either work or it won't. It might not work. Try as you may wish, even though you have certain meditation skills, it may not work. Then what do you do? Well, usually I recommend to people, if they come to me with a behavioral issue, something that is objective they're doing in the world that they want to stop doing, or something objective that they're not doing in the world that they want to start doing, okay? Because it's both sides, right? I will recommend that they adopt a two-prong approach. One is use the practice to deal with the urges, either the urge to do the behavior or the urge to avoid the behavior. So that I've already described how to do that. You break it into its sensory components. You break the urge when it comes up in the moment, and you apply the practice. But there's a second thing that may be necessary, and in fact often is necessary. In addition to this practice, you may need to create for yourself a behaviorally oriented support structure, or another way to put it is an accountability structure, an objective accountability structure. Now, that's pretty fancy sounding. Can someone explain what I mean by that in Hebrew? Let me make it tangible. You may need to join a 12-step program, or have a psychotherapist, or have a counselor, or have a life coach, or have a friend that you report to who is giving you assignments and making sure that you're fulfilling those assignments to make the behavior change. So I'm assuming in this country that you have what we call the 12-step program. Yes. Is that correct? Yes. Is that widely used?
Yes.
Well, it's very widely used in the United States, and very successfully used. The 11th step is called prayer and meditation. Conveniently, meditation is incorporated right in. And in the United States, sometimes they have 12-step meetings where they emphasize meditation, and they call them 11th step meetings. Okay, so there are a lot of people that use that, and that is a behaviorally oriented program. If you are not keeping up your abstinence and whatever, you have to, like, you know, admit it. You know, there's somebody that you report to objectively that's in charge of making sure that you're actually changing behavior. So this practice is very useful and very powerful for making behavior changes, but often it has to be combined with some sort of structure on the outside, someone you're reporting to, often a professional like a therapist or a counselor, but maybe a friend or a sponsor. Maybe use a 12-step for that. And those two together can be very helpful. I told you the story, the sort of miraculous story of, well, I was sweeping through my body, Ubakin method, and without any this or that, I went home, and a 10-year, all-day, intense marijuana addiction simply evaporated without any effort at all. It's not always that easy, okay? That was pretty dramatic. On the other hand, I've always had a tendency to procrastinate. Put things off. Do things... see, I'm... how can I put it? It might not seem so, but I'm basically a lazy person. I only want to play. The good news is some of the things that I call play, other people call work, like this, okay? So I've been able to get by, but actual work, something I don't want to do that's not play, is very, very difficult for me to discipline myself. So, for example, writing a book, to me, that's like work. Okay, I can talk forever, and it's no problem. And you call me, I'll talk, okay? writer's block, you know, how difficult it is to, like, actually put it on paper. I'm a perfectionist. It, you know, I go over it and over it, I put it off. You know, it's very difficult to get books published in general. Big New York publishing companies come to me, give me contracts, $50,000. They come to me, I don't have to go to them. And I end up not writing the book. I have to give the money back. You know, we're laughing now, but it's not so funny, I'll tell you. When it actually happens and you get a bad reputation among the publishers of the world as someone that can't complete it, you know. I mean, my students have written bestseller books. Where's mine? Well, I'm very lazy in that regard. And in a lot of other things. He's laughing because he knows he has to deal with it. So, a number of years ago, I decided I'm going to have to try to come to grips with this. And I tried and I couldn't. And so I found a psychiatrist in Burlington, where I live, and I said, you know, hey, I don't need to be any happier, okay? I don't need to know myself any better. I don't need to know my biography, you know, and why I was formed the way, you know. But there is this one thing that I'm supposed to finish this project, and every day I blow it off. can you help me change this behavior? And he said, well, I think so. So a combination, it took 18 months. Every day I went, and this is like, this isn't like a psychologist. This is like MD psychiatrist, you know, the real thing, a shrink, heavy duty. So, no, to be completely honest, if it had cost anything, I would not have done it. My insurance covered it. Cigna. Health insurance paid for that. It cost the insurance company a lot of money, but it didn't cost me anything. He would give me assignments, okay, small, manageable tasks that I was supposed to do, and then I would apply my practice, try to do it. Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. But, you know, after eight, and then, yeah, he's a psychiatrist, so sure enough, about, you know, 2 months into it, it's like, well, would you be willing to try SSRIs? That means, let's see, what did he try? Lexapro, I think. It's like, you know, it's a psychotropic antidepressant medication. Well, hey, you know, I'm willing to try anything. So, took it, and turned out it was totally irrelevant to my situation. But at least I tried it, you know, it didn't do any good at all. First made me high, then made me weird, and then... so that wasn't the answer. So then, you know, basically time passes, and I was making small behavioral changes, and things got better, and I can now complete tasks. But it was a combination of my own practice and an external support structure that I went about and created. So I just share with you that you probably have things in your life that are behavior issues. It's objective. It's something you're doing that you would rather stop, or something that you should be doing that you can't get yourself to do. So some combination of working with the urges in terms of mindfulness, either the techniques I've given you or some other technique, plus you may need to use, as I say, 12-step program. Let's say that you have a substance issue, okay, or what have you, an eating issue, then, you know, external support structure that's monitoring your behavior, that you're accountable to, plus this practice is a very good combination. So I just, I wanted to share that idea with you, because part of happiness independent of conditions is, okay, you can experience uncomfortable touch and feel, it hurts but it doesn't cause suffering, so that's for the body experience. Your mind knows the answer to the ultimate question, who am I? So then your happiness is not dependent on the mind anymore. But in addition to your body and mind, we have behavior, what we actually do and say day to day in the world. And the unconditional happiness there is that your behavior, personal ethics are the best you can do, and your personal performance is the best you can do. If you do that, then we say that your happiness is independent of conditions. Whether you're successful or not, you did your best. So that's an aspect of let's call it, that I wanted to address specifically. As I say, sometimes people accuse this practice of being a form of narcissism. I don't know if you're familiar with that word. Okay, narcissism means self-involvement. It's like, well, you're just sitting there on the cushion, involved with yourself, and you're, you know, being, you know, feeling good, etc., etc. Well, there's nothing wrong with feeling good, but this practice is also about actual changes in behaviors, and this is the model that I like to give people with regards to that. I wanted to say a few words about what to expect after our retreat. Actually, we have a significant number of people here for whom this is their first intensive retreat, which is, you know, boy, congratulations for doing this. You sort of jumped in the deep end of the pond. But even those of you that have done retreats before, it's sort of good to remember. The way that I like to formulate it is, when you leave the retreat, exactly one of four things is going to happen. I love these are called partitions of logical possibilities, mathematically speaking. Okay, so there's exactly four things that are going to happen to you vis-a-vis the effect of the retreat. One is that you will have what I call afterglow. I don't know if you have an idiom that corresponds to this, afterglow. Like, after you make love, it's sort of like glowing. I say we call that afterglow. Yeah, after the event, you get, there's still a sort of glowing, okay? So afterglow means you leave the retreat and you're very calm and you're very energized and you get one insight after another. Okay, you will have no difficulty processing afterglow. By way of contrast, there can be a phenomenon that I refer to as aftershock. You're very sensitive to the, overly sensitized to the outside world. On the inside, stuff is just coming up in chaotic ways. It seems like you're disoriented, okay, and you don't have firm ground to stand on, and so forth. So that's aftershock. So one possibility is afterglow only. Second possibility is aftershock only. Third possibility is both. And the fourth possibility is neither. So, if you have afterglow, you know what to do. Just enjoy it. It may last or it may not. Eventually, it will last. Eventually, it will become permanent. What about the aftershock? So, you only need to remember a couple things. First of all, why is it happening? And second of all, what to do about it? So we can say that the normal human coping mechanism for dealing with pressures from the outside and pressures from the inside, the normal human coping mechanism could be succinctly characterized with four words. No, five words. Tighten up and turn away. Okay? Follow what I mean by this? Okay? Like, build a defense and ignore it. This practice is about coping with the world and ourselves by open up and turn towards. It's exactly the opposite. Open up is the equanimity, okay? The dropping of the shields. Turn towards is, okay, we're going to pay attention to it, not ignore it. So, in other words, the usual coping mechanism, tighten up and turn away, sort of protects us from the intensities of the outside and the stored poison and pain that's on the inside. it sort of protects us, but doesn't really protect us. Because inevitably the arrows get through that shield. So a wise person comes to a point in their development where they realize that there must be a better way of coping with the what comes from the outside and what's been stored on the inside. And there is. And we're doing it. Unfortunately, this coping mechanism is the exact opposite of the usual one. The usual one is tighten up and turn away. This one is open up and turn towards. In other words, we're in remember I've used this phrase several times, awkward intermediate zone. Okay, awkward means uncomfortable, things don't quite fit. Intermediate means in between. In between what? In between two strategies for dealing with stresses. And the strategies are the opposite. Okay? So it makes sense that in between, you're going to occasionally be aware that the old coping mechanism of close the mesh, it's been somewhat shed, but the new coping mechanism of open the mesh so wide that nothing can stick isn't yet in place. When that happens, you get aftershock. It seems like you're like very sensitive to the outside. Everything hits you, and there's all this stuff percolating up on the inside. And you think that you're doing something wrong, but actually you're doing something right. You just haven't done it enough yet. that the things can just pass through you. So there's no going back. Okay? You have to just keep opening up and turn towards, open and turn towards. So that's why it's happening. You're in between two ways of dealing with the world. One that sort of works, but not really. The other one that really works, but is sort of the opposite of what most people do. So you can't avoid a sort of messy in-between situation from time to time. So that's what's happening. It's not a sign meaning the aftershock, is not a sign you've done anything wrong. It's actually a sign you're doing things right. Now, the other thing to remember is what to do about it. Well, you already know what to do about it. Recycle the reaction, okay? The aftershock, where is it coming up? In feel? Yeah, probably. Maybe image, maybe talk. Could involve even the physical body. So you know how to work with that. You have procedures, and you just do what you can. You apply the techniques, and at some point, that layer works its way through. We can describe this path as a journey from the surface of consciousness to the source of consciousness. That's the way I like to look at it. If we think of ordinary experience, conventional reality, as being the surface of a sphere, And this sphere is consciousness. Consciousness comes in three basic flavors: somatic, visual, and auditory. You can start anywhere on the surface. And you're going to make a journey. It's a journey straight down to the to the source. Now, as you go from surface to source, the closer you get to the source, the better you feel, of course. On the other hand, as you go deeper down, you expose more primitive fossils, more primitive, it's like the earth, okay? As you dig down into the earth, you know, you dig down a few feet, you find maybe some dog bones or something, okay, chicken bones, but fossil. But if you dig down further, maybe you find dinosaur bones, okay, and so forth. They're more primitive, earlier layers. So as you go from the surface of your consciousness towards the source, on one hand, you feel better and better and better. On the other hand, you expose more and more infantile, that's baby-like, and animalistic layers, more and more primitive layers that have not been resolved get exposed. So that's what the fact that you're getting closer to the source is what gives you the afterglow. The exposing of the more primitive levels of blockage is what gives you the aftershock. So it's not a sign that you're doing something wrong. It's just a sign that you're encountering a more primitive level of sankhara or sankhara. Sankhara in Pali, sankhara in Sanskrit. These are the limiting forces within us that are stored from the past. The sankhara, it's the same root as karma. It's what's stored that gets in the way of us directly contacting the pure spirit of the source. So when you have uncomfortable things, it's like you have these wonderful experiences and then it seems like you're back where you started. But that's not true. You're still making progress, but it becomes evident that you also have to deal with more primitive material. So if you think about it this way, then that gives you a model for what's happening in terms of afterglow and aftershock, and also gives you a sense, and then you'll also hopefully remember what to do about it, which is just apply your practice. Let me see here. Five words. Tighten up and turn away, as opposed to open up and turn towards. So that was the phraseology. So, the other thing to keep in mind when you leave the retreat is to keep up your practice. There's a tendency sometimes to think, I worked really hard, so I'm going to goof off for a while, etc., etc. But it's actually the days right after the retreat, you have this momentum, okay? And it's very powerful if you go right back to your regular practice and so forth. What I usually encourage people to do is sign up for your next retreat. As soon as you leave a retreat, look at your calendar, see what you want to do next, and pay a down payment on the retreat, make a reservation, and mark it in ink on your calendar, and tell everybody you're going to do it. So you paid money, and it's marked in ink, so you're going to have to like white it out to get rid of it. And you brag to all your friends that you're going to do this next retreat. And if after each retreat you plan and make the commitment for the next retreat, then you're guaranteed a lifetime of retreats. So, and that's important. At this retreat, I have had a chance to introduce you to what many of you have told me has been some useful terminology and concepts. There is a large structure to the way that I teach meditation. What you will have learned in this retreat is it's a pretty good piece of that structure, but it's not the big picture. But it's plenty, okay? All you need is one technique. If you wish to continue to explore this particular way of doing mindfulness, it is very easy for you to do that. You go to the website www.basicmindfulness.org. I think you probably all were sent this URL when you registered for the retreat, but we'll put it up. And there is a description there of something that I call the home practice program. And it's every month. It's the second weekend of every month. It runs from Friday through Sunday in North America. Of course, that's, you know, a day different in this part of the world. You look at the different retreats. They're usually 4 hours long. Some of them have prerequisites, but by having completed this retreat, you have the prerequisites to do most of the programs. And so you decide one or several that you would like to do, and you register by email, and we send you an access code and a telephone number. You can Skype in if you don't have cheap long distance, or you can get cheap long distance. So then you call in that number at that time, and we do a 4-hour sort of micro retreat. And you do it in your, wherever you may be. There's usually a period of guidance, like I've done here. Then there's some question and answer. Then there's a time for you to work on your own. You hang up. And during that time, you can call me and talk to me if you want. And then we all come back. There's some more Q&A, a final guidance period, and it's over. So I know it's hard to imagine how this works by telephone in your home. If you try to imagine it, you can't. But once you actually do it, you'll see it works out extremely well. So this means that anyone can have this practice in the world, because although there's a token registration fee, we can waive that. You never have to pay for it, okay? So you don't have to travel, you don't have to leave your family, you don't have to leave your work, you don't have to have anything except some sort of cheap internet access and the ability to understand English at this point, although I'm working on a Spanish language version of this, eventually a Chinese, and et cetera, and who knows, maybe one of you will become a facilitator and do a Hebrew version of this one of these days. Anyway, it's readily available to you, and you might want to give it a try. Otherwise, just use local talent. Use the many good teachers that are available to you in this area. As I say, my goal for you is not that you learn my system. It's that you understand that all the systems are complementary, and therefore, you're in a position to make use of whatever resources are available to you. That's how that works. Oh, I should say that every month there's always at least one of those 4-hour programs that requires no previous experience in any form of meditation. So if you have somebody that you would like, you think might want to learn this, but they're in a situation where they can't come to a retreat for whatever reason, But they can get 4 hours, you know, on a Sunday or something like that, a Saturday. Then they can begin by joining that program. So it's, it gives both initial instruction and ongoing month-to-month support in the practice. So that's a resource that's available. Essentially, I like to teach people how to work with what I call three aspects of experience. One is ordinary experience. We've worked with touch, sight, touch, feel, image, talk. The other ordinary experience is sight, and then there's sound. So you can work with ordinary experience by noting it, observing it. That's one way. Or with regards to the subjective side of ordinary experience, the feel, image, talk, in addition to noting and observing it, you can intentionally create positive states. So one theme is we're going to work with ordinary experiences, either in terms of just observing what is, or by way of contrast, intentionally creating positive states that we do with the feel, image, talk. So that's sort of the two techniques that work with our ordinary sensory experience. So we note it, or we can create positive in the subjective part of it. Then there's restful experience. We've been exploring four flavors of rest. I've got two others, so that it's sort of a parallel system. So there's one way to work and enjoy restful experiences is to note restful states. And that is a noting process, and that involves a certain amount of efforting, as you have seen. And it is essentially my reworking of the shamatha aspect of practice, which is the tranquilizing side of the practice from early Buddhism. However, I have another way of working with the theme of rest. It's a sort of absolute rest where you don't even note anything. You just drop all effort. And some of you have noticed that as you're practicing, you'll be drawn to just sort of, let's not do anything anymore. Let's not note, let's not do anything. Just stop all doing. And that's a whole approach. In Zen, it's called just sitting. Krishnamurti called it choiceless awareness. Papaji calls it call off the search. And in Tibetan Buddhism, it's you have two ways of doing it, one called Dzogchen, the other called Mahamudra. So there's a place for that. So I have two ways of teaching you how to enjoy pleasant, restful experiences. One is note restful flavors, that brings a lot of clarity into the restful experience. And then there's the do nothing, which tends to produce a kind of depth. But if the doing nothing makes you spacey, then you can note the restful flavors to bring clarity into the experience. On the other hand, if the noting makes you racy, speeds things up too much, then you can go for the do nothing.
What do you mean by spacey?
Spacey means lack clarity. Racy means agitated.
Like sinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sinking is the spacey. Yeah, spacey means you're spaced out, okay? we want you to be spacious. We don't want you to be spacey. Okay, so I'll eventually teach you two contrasting ways of working with restful states, and I'll teach you two contrasting ways of working with ordinary experience. Then, as some of you have begun to notice, both ordinary experiences, touch, sight, sound, feel, image, talk, and restful sensory experiences can begin to sort of like flow and turn into energy. That is a side of experience that I call the dynamic side. Now, dynamic is an interesting word in English, because dynamic means both change and the forces and energy that produces change. It has both of those meanings. So sometimes you become aware of the dynamic side of experience. In traditional Buddhism, that's called insight into impermanence, anicca. But it's related to the notion of qi that you have in East Asian medicine and martial arts. And indeed, it's related to the notion of ruach, or spirit, that you have in the Western formulations of things. How the spirit works within to purify consciousness. That's the energia, the inner working. And if that impermanence aspect or dynamic aspect presents itself, we don't try to make it happen, but when it happens, it's good to be able to work with it as a distinctive theme. I'll give you two ways of doing that. One is to work with the continuous sort of wavy, vibrating part of it. I call that noting flow. And the other one is to work with the abrupt vanishings of things. Essentially, the moment when something disappears is a very magic and powerful moment. There's nothing mystical schmystical about disappearing, okay? You listen to an airplane, okay, and you hear the airplane, and then at some point you don't hear the airplane anymore. The sound vanished. Inside talk space, yadda yadda, then it stops for a minute, then yadda yadda, okay, and then there's a period at the end of the sentence. Then yadda yadda, then there's a period at the end of the sentence. Well, each end of those sentences, that's a vanishing. You listen to music. Tomorrow we're going to do music meditation. One of the ways you can do music meditation is, instead of listening to the sound, you can listen to the moment when the sound vanishes. And I actually teach people how to label the moment of vanishing. The label is gone, okay? Gati, gati, paragati, okay? So or gate, gate, paragati, so gone. So, for example, Vivaldi. Da 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 da, gone. Da 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 da, gone. Da da da, gone. Da 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 da, gone! Okay? Each one of those moments of vanishing points your attention to the unborn source. So, that's a whole theme that I have people work on. And, by the way, I didn't just make this up. If you read the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, written in Sri Lanka, 1,500 years ago, it is the classic manual for Vipassana meditation in much of Southeast Asia. The author, Buddhaghosa, describes Satta Visuddhaya. That's seven steps in the path to enlightenment. Enlightenment meaning stream entry in this case. And he talks about various steps. It's sort of interesting. And there's one step where your awareness is dominated by Udayabhaya, rising and passing, rising, passing, okay? That rhythm. After that comes the step where your consciousness is dominated by a sense of passing, passing, okay? As soon as something is arising, as soon as it's expanding into existence, it is simultaneously contracting. No sooner is there affirmation, but the negation is right there. No, okay, as soon as yang is there, yin is there, and you're drawn to watching the gone, the vanishing. Now, there is a word in Sanskrit that has no equivalent in English or any language, because it means both disappearance and total happiness. And that word is nirvana. So watching the vanishings of things. What do I mean by things? mental image, bursts of internal talk, external sound, flow, the energy itself, the vibrations, sort of vibrates and gone, okay? The wave is there and then the wave goes flat. So one of the themes, I have you work with the dynamic side of experience in two ways. One is to note continuous change, I call that flow. The other is to note when things vanish, and I call that noting vanishing. So you'll have two ways of working with the dynamic side of experience, two ways of working with the ordinary side of experience, and two ways of working with the restful side of experience. If you look at the totality of the Buddhist practice tradition over the three vehicles and the last 2,500 years, you'll see that basically I've stolen all the major innovations and put them into an integrated and rather secular system. So you don't have to learn all these things, but there's a high probability that at least one of these approaches will work well for you. And so that's sort of what the that's all you need. You just need one approach. Maybe for you it's going to be the do nothing. That really does it for you. Or maybe it'll be, who knows, noting vanishings or loving kindness, you know, focus on positive. So that's just a brief description of the resource that I can provide for you, both in terms of delivery system by telephone on a monthly basis and in terms of what the content would be. But as I say, once again, my main goal is not to get you to do this system. It's to get you to be able to be set up for a lifetime of mindfulness practice and to see the sort of underlying unity of the system in its worldwide manifestations, East and West. So you're doing great. Got a few more days. Keep it up.